Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Under the Ring Pro Wrestling Conversations. My name is Chris Trump. So glad you joined me this week. Our guest is the founder of Slam Wrestling, but more importantly for our purposes here, an expert on halls of fame in pro wrestling. It's founder of Slam Wrestling, Greg Oliver. He's written books that were branded as the Hall of Fame, which if you haven't read them, you should. He's worked with the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame and with Cauliflower Alley Club. And he has a lot of opinions on what wrestling history is and what it's not and what it looks like and what it should be. So I thought it was apropos with the WWE Hall of Fame coming up in Philadelphia April 5th to get him on to break down the Hall of Fame as a concept in pro wrestling. So here we go with my interview with Greg Oliver. So pleased to be joined today by the founder of Slam Wrestling and an expert on pro wrestling halls of fame, Greg Oliver. Greg, welcome to Under the Ring Pro Wrestling Conversations. How are you doing today?
Hi, Phil. Thanks for having me on the show. Everything's good. I got my cup of tea here. I'm ready to talk old school stuff. For sure, the Hall of Fames are in the news these days.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we start, can you explain your connection to the business and its history to our listeners in kind of brief 1 minute form?
A brief one. Good luck with that. I've been writing about pro wrestling since, it was 1985 when I started a newsletter. I went to journalism school in Toronto. I worked at the Toronto Sun newspaper. I did a newsletter for 5 years, stopped it to go to university. And then after university, I ended up with a job at the Toronto Sun newspaper. That led to a job as the web developed and starting at the Sun's website. And that led to Slam Wrestling. So, which happened to coincide with, late 1996 as the Attitude Era is taking off. And, I got sort of late 1997. And then it took off from there. We've been writing about wrestling ever since. I've done 20 different books. About 12 of them have, connections of some sort to pro wrestling. That may be something like a Medusa's book, which is obviously wrestling, but it's got a hell of a lot more in there. The most recent one is just called Run with the Bull. It's about a comedian named Eric Johnston, but his father, uncle, and grandfather were all pro wrestlers. So it's a neat little tie-in. So anyways, I've been writing about wrestling a long time, to say the least.
And we had Medusa on this show when that book came out too, and that was really fun to do. And I, since you're here too, I tend to wear this shirt a lot when I'm on here, but I decided to wear a hockey shirt today just to commemorate. So, I like to start with the 2024 WWE Hall of Fame happens Friday, April 5th in Philly. This year, inductees are Paul Heyman, the U.S. Express, Barry Windham and Mike Rotunda, Bull Nakano, Muhammad Ali, Thunderbolt Patterson, and it's also been reported now that promoter Liam Iavia will be part of that class, also the grandmother of The Rock. What are your thoughts when you look at that induction class for the WWE Hall of Fame?
Well, first off, I'm not sure they're going to do, it would be really smart if they held Leah to another year when The Rock is not a hated figure. He's going to get up there and be booed as he's inducting his grandmother. It would make zero sense if they did that. The rest of the class, there's some strong names. It just does make you sort of puzzle sometimes how they come up with it, whether there's some sort of behind-the-scenes machinations going on. Why Thunderbolt Patterson this year? I recognize he's a preacher. He's going to get up there, give a nice fiery little speech. But, I wonder why. Bull Nakano, absolutely deserving, but not even the greatest, Japanese woman wrestler of all time. Where's Nagano? Where's, Aja Khan, some of the other ones? And Bull's up there, but I'm not sure anybody would say she's the greatest. Mayumi Toyota. So you wonder sometimes how they came up with this. It's fun. It doesn't get the focus it used to, right? It's just part of SmackDown now. Or the hour afterwards. So it's not like it's a whole evening. You go sit there and get Sherry Martel going off on some crazy rant and yelling at fans and all the stuff that made the WWE Hall of Fame really great.
Yeah, I always enjoyed those types of ones. Hers, I remember I was in attendance at Bob Backlund's, which was just like, I was doubled over. I couldn't even breathe. I was laughing so hard at his. Like, you had those fun moments. I like it. It's just, and I know it has like, you know, a Hall of Fame in a work sport is hard enough to come up with what your criteria for who gets in even is. And then when it's the WWE Hall of Fame, there's the attachment of, okay, you're booking someone and you have to be in favor with the company and they actually have to want to honor you and pay you. So this year's, though, we were talking a little bit offline about Thunderbolt. Like, this just doesn't look like a Vince McMahon type class to me this year. It's very different in its direction. And I kind of wonder behind the scenes kind of if there's been some sort of change in terms of how they, you know, by committee or however they do it, how they pick out who goes. What do you think?
Well, the first thing I will say is you mentioned like all the other Halls of Fame. Like, this is one of the things that make us feel more legitimate as wrestling fans, doesn't it? Because we can argue about who belongs in a Hall of Fame. It sounds like you're talking about Cooperstown or the Hockey Hall of Fame or Canton, where the Football Hall of Fame is. We can debate this, and it makes it all seem much more legitimate than watching pro wrestling when you know it's a work sport. So this, like I said, I think we just get off on this as fans because it makes us feel more legit. But that's an interesting thing. It's not a McMahon class. I think certainly Wyndham and Rotunda would be ones he might have gotten to. Mm-hmm. He might have rushed out to do the Bray Wyatt, but I think they waited. They're going to wait another year and do that. But yeah, the Bull Nakano, what she left on weird terms with WWE. You know, Medusa in her book talked about there was a failed drug test. They've never talked about it. She's never really talked about it. She was just gone. I think there are just more people in there that appreciate the greater scope of pro wrestling history that are now a part of it. And it's not just on Vince's whim. Yeah. And to me, that's great. I would like them to be a little bit more open about how they do things. I helped with the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame. I 1 year I was their voting chairman. So I made the list. We sent out the note. I collected all the votes. Other years I was just on the voting committee. With the Cauliflower Alley Club, I've helped them numerous times with suggestions. It was my idea that Sting got it this year.
Nice.
You know, those kind of things. Dory Funk Jr., when he got his the other year, a couple years ago, the Art Abrams Lifetime Achievement Award, that was my idea. I like helping people get recognition for what they've done, especially in a strange sport like pro wrestling. And whether it's writing about somebody who died who may not be well known, or whether it's a Hall of Fame where we can celebrate their accomplishments while they're still around, they all have value, and everybody in life wants to be appreciated a little bit, I guess, right? We appreciate you, Phil.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate you as well. What common themes do you see in Pro Wrestling Halls of Fame, and what do you think should be the criteria for being in a Hall of Fame of pro wrestling, and where do people kind of totally miss on this type of stuff?
Well, there's sort of the different levels, isn't there? Like, I really like what they've done in Iowa with the Tragos Thez Hall of Fame, because they sort of wanted you to have legitimate background as an amateur wrestler and or that great skill set that comes with it. So the people that they've inducted there, you can't really question their criteria. You just wonder sometimes why somebody's not in there yet. Like Brock Lesnar and Shelton Benjamin are both going to be in there at some point, but are not yet. Kurt Angle waited a couple of years until he was able to attend before they inducted him. So those kind of things make it seem so much more legit. And there's that word again coming up in relation to pro wrestling. But the other ones, again, there's a little bit of a group putting things together, trying to recognize the past, especially because it gets overlooked so much. And then today's stuff, though, it's like the same guys being honored again and again, right? How many Halls of Fame is Ric Flair in? Do they all mean something to him? Of course. But I'm not sure it's his end-all be-all that, hey, I'm in the NWA Hall of Fame. I'm in the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame. I'm in the International Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame. And if you go back to the days of, what was it, Ring Wrestling had its own ring, you know, wrestling Hall of Fame too. Like, I'm sure Flair's in there. So yeah, it's a weird thing, eh? But the WWE Hall of Fame seems to mean the most to everybody because they pay the people to go. So in the end, it's a payday.
Yeah, it's a payday. I've seen a lot of people argue like, oh, well, the WWE Hall of Fame isn't legitimate because they don't have a building. But if anybody knows anything about Halls of Fame, they're generally not big money makers. I mean, you can have some tourism surrounding it. Basically, I've been to Cooperstown before, and that whole town pretty much operates on the tourism of the Baseball Hall of Fame. But it's really not cost effective to have a site unless you can really make it work. And it's obviously probably – it has to have been brought up in WWE before, and they have to have said no multiple times, I'm sure.
Yeah, and you do wonder if they'd gone down the road and been bought by, say, Disney – you know, maybe they would have established something permanent on one of the Disneylands or something like that, right? Like that would have made sense. For that matter, there's no, I don't think there's any Hall of Fame for the UFC either. So maybe there's a combination that'll make sense at some point down the road. And again, you end up with these competing things. Working on Medusa's book, like there was like sort of two different monster truck Halls of Fame. Like one is Monster Jam itself, which is like the WWE having its own Hall of Fame. And the other was a bigger picture Monster Truck Hall of Fame. And she's not in either, which she's more than happy to tell you she belongs in. It's always subjective. And as I said, it's entertaining for us fans to sit yeah. here and shoot the bull about.
Are there any eras or areas, geographic areas of pro wrestling you think are commonly overlooked? And kind of at what point does a candidate lose steam towards inclusion? I feel like there's a lot of time that passes sometimes and people just get lost in history. And I have a few examples of that that I wrote down, but.
Oh, there's so many of those examples of people that are just lost. That's a great word for it. Or they're just forgotten. The thing is, wrestling's so territorial, right? So like a Whitey Caldwell that meant everything down there in, you know, Tennessee and the Gulf Coast, those kind of guys were monstrous stars. And yet, if you would never know about him in California unless you read the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame Heroes and Icon. So how do you apply that criteria to a greater picture, right? These guys were incredibly important in that moment and in that time. I often use this example. So Whipper Billy Watson was the biggest star in Canadian wrestling history, period. He was the one that was there as TV started, that Canadians across the country got to know him. You know, they, as you got a TV, you'd sit around and watch wrestling and boxing, same as in the US when it started. But, you know, he was a hero in Canada. And in the US, though, the equivalent is Gorgeous George. Doesn't that say everything about the two countries, right? We have a hero in Canada that was known by everybody, but it was a villain in the US that was known by everybody. But everybody would say Gorgeous George, one of the most important guys in history. And yet Whipper Billy Watson, not in the WWE Hall of Fame. I don't think he got inducted in the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame before that all went to hell. So again, it's a place and a time, and it's so easy to overlook, you know, who's the top star in Brazil? Who is the top star in Belize? Like there was pro wrestling everywhere around the world. And we are so arrogant and talk about how important it is, the North American scene alone, and often dismiss what other people meant in other places.
Yeah, and I mean, Watson was a huge star everywhere he went to. One guy for me, as I watch somewhat older footage, that stood out to me to be an obvious WWE Hall of Fame candidate who's just not, and I don't know why. I think he was a very big star when he was around, was Edouard Carpentier. Like, and he was a big star in New York.
Yeah, no, you're right. He headlined the Garden many times. Yeah, it's a weird choice. But again, he's not around anymore, so it doesn't have that cachet. And how many, you know, old timers that are long gone do you want to put in? That's why they came up with that, you know, legacy wing that they threw a bunch of people in together, which was a bit ridiculous, especially when they didn't bother telling family members and didn't make a big deal out of it.
Yeah,
it just seemed really unfair because, you know, baseball, for all its issues with Cooperstown, and there's always people we wonder why they're in there. When somebody makes it into the Hall of Fame after years of somebody campaigning for a name long gone, it's an accomplishment. In wrestling, it's like, oh, yeah, here's a whole bunch more names.
Yeah, I liked the idea for the legacy wing, but like you said, the execution of it, when you had they were messing up photos and video packages and putting the wrong person on one I could think of in particular, and then, you know, just Brody, I think it was Bruiser Brody's family, who wasn't even aware that he was being inducted into the Hall of Fame. I mean, you have to you have to make it mean something is the whole point of having it. For me, like you talked a little bit about Cooperstown. I want what's honored to be representative of the eras I was aware of or watched. And like every walk of life, you're going to have, like, this is where I fall on this with like WWE's Hall of Fame, but also other wrestling halls of fame too. You're going to have troubling characters who probably would not exactly crack a Hall of Fame of human beings. Is there anybody like that who you know, you think has been kept out, you know, for honestly, Thunderbolt is an interesting one this year because like he was so into workers' rights and unionization of pro wrestling and that kind of thing. I never would have thought in a million years he'd end up in.
Absolutely, yeah. No, Thunderbolt's a guy that rocked the boat. But he was also a top star. You can't deny that, right? There's other guys that rocked the boat, like a Jim Wilson, who never was a main event guy really anywhere, right? And so you can dismiss those guys pretty easily. But it doesn't mean that those lesser guys, the enhancement guys, the carpenters, the jobbers, as they like to say, they're hugely important to the business too. Like, the fact that they just have Johnny Rods is sort of the encapsulating everybody in WWE history who did jobs is both great that they've acknowledged that, but bad in the sense that it's like, man, there's so many other people that helped build this business. And there's, you know, one referee in there, isn't there? Just Tim White so far. So there's just so much history that wrestling is not about a single person, right? Nobody becomes a star on their own. And yeah, so you wonder about a guy like Thunderbolt. There's a lot of those kind of guys that even years later, you wonder about, are they going to have to go visit these people, right? Your Roberto Alomar, right, came down from the Blue Jays, you know, level of excellence because of all the stuff that went down with him.
Right.
I mean, in wrestling, if you started doing that, who are you going to have left? You know, they're all questionable characters. They have to be almost questionable characters and egomaniacs because pro wrestling, by its very definition, you have to believe in yourself, right? You have to have an ego. You have to know you're the best to be able to go out there and perform every day. And if you don't believe in yourself, the promoter's not going to believe in you, your opponent's not going to believe in you, and the fans aren't going to believe in you. So there's no reason for you to be there. So it's just, again, we're back to this work thing. It's such a weird dichotomy that ends up in pro wrestling. And I think that's why we love it.
Yeah, I love debating it and talking about it too. Like, and if you look through the WWE Hall of Fame and some of the people who are in that you could say, like, oh, well, no, but, you know, you could have an argument against almost nearly everyone who's in it for something, whether it's the Ultimate Warrior, Jimmy Snuka with the stuff that went on back in Allentown in the 80s with his trial and then being unfit to stand trial. Referee wise, Tim White is the only one. I'm not even positive they inducted him really as a referee either. I think it was more for his greater contributions to the company. Teddy Long is in too, but again, that's not really him as a referee either. It was more of his on-screen role later on. I know it's in the Hockey Hall of Fame, or at least it was at one point. They always had a category for builders, people who contributed to the sport's growth over time. I wonder if you did that for pro wrestling, what type of people you would find in there?
Well, you get these books that have come out, like Ballyhoo by John Langmead, right, where you talk about guys like Jack Curley and Jack Pfeffer, and you know, they're just characters from the get-go, and they're so great to write about and to research and learn about. But man, Hall of Fame, you know, that kind of idea, yeah, it's all about questionable practices, because there was not the same oversight that there was in the main sports, right? When a Charlie Finley is a character as an owner with, you know, the Oakland A's, and he owned the Golden Seals for a bit in the NHL. Yeah. You know, that's just a fascinating guy, right? We really enjoyed learning about him. Whatever business practices he did, he still had a big other, you know, real life out there where he made his money. But in pro wrestling, everybody's a huckster. Everybody's sort of trying to cut everybody else off at the knees. You're always trying to get ahead of the other guys. You're backstabbing everybody. It's just such a wild thing that, yeah, nobody gets in based on being an angel, for sure. A builder category, if you explained it like that, I think it could work. But WWE Hall of Fame has gone so far down the road of just sort of randomly putting people in there that I'm not sure it could ever be rehabilitated in that way and start putting actual categories. Instead, it's like you sort of just look and you go, oh, well, there's the quota. Okay, there's their African-American. There's their tag team. There's their woman for this year. And that's great that they're trying to be representative, but it also just absolutely strikes you as being obvious every year that they're trying to hit those certain key points.
And actually, Ultimate Warrior's actual pitch for what the Warrior Award should be every year was basically that behind-the-scenes person, specifically in WWE, was what he was saying, who has an impact. And some years they've done it with that, and some years it's like Eric LeGrand. Some years it's, you know, other people. So it's like, I think there's certain ways, and I don't think it always has to be promoters with that kind of thing either. Like, I think there's so many different people. There's wrestling, I mean, Bill Apter is somebody who immediately comes to mind as somebody who enhanced the business in a lot of unique ways that isn't in there, is in the Wrestling Observer one. And I'm sure he's in some others that I'm not remembering off the top of my head too, but there's a number of different tentacles within wrestling that you could sort of, you know, maneuver different people in for different categories. Cause it's more than just wrestlers and it's more than just managers and promoters.
You know, I mean, with the thing with Bill and George Napolitano and your Lou Eskins and all those kind of guys is that, you know, without them, these guys didn't get the publicity nationally that, you know, we take for granted now, right? The web, all of a sudden you're available worldwide. But back in the day, you know, you wanted that magazine coverage. And so if they put you in there, all of a sudden they're reading about you in California, it meant that you could maybe then go out there and work in California and have a little bit of a fan base already set up. It wasn't until, you know, TBS came along and guys like Tommy Rich started getting known across the US. And I say the US because it was a long time before TBS was available in Canada. Like, all of a sudden you wanted to send people to Georgia so they could be on TBS. So they became a bigger star. And there's so many of those people like that through the years. And that's a little bit. So in Iowa, at the Dan Gable Museum there, they have the Melby Award there, which is sort of a little bit more key to journalism. So George Napolitano, Bill Apter, they've sort of been honored there. The Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame, when it existed, honored George Napolitano and Bill Apter. Then there's the Cauliflower Alley Club, which we haven't even talked about as well, which is essentially, to anybody who doesn't know about it, it's the Alumni Association of Pro Wrestling. That's the easiest way to explain it. They try to look after people who fall through the cracks and the things, you know, that maybe their life didn't go the way they planned. I mean, when Kamala was in rough shape, they sent him some money. And that's one of the public ones. A lot of them have been very private and they don't tell people about the money they've shared. But those people being honored there, I've always said, the thing about the CAC is you're being honored by your peers. So when you get the Iron Mike Mazurki Award, which is by far the top award in professional wrestling, you are the elite of the elite because you are known outside of the pro wrestling business for your high moral standard, all those kind of things that really speak to a personality beyond just what you did in the ring. So I always trumpet what the CAC does. I don't always agree with it, but as far as, you know, being honored by your peers, I think that in the end means so much more than the whims of WWE. Or even historians voting you in into some of these other halls of fame, because, you know, historians are going to be limited by what they know, where they learned it, what they saw, their own personal biases.
I need to get better connected with the Cauliflower Alley Club myself. It's something that I've often thought about and just never acted on it or missed a contact with somebody or something. But I want to be better connected with that.
There's nobody in pro wrestling who should not be a member. Everybody should be in there. It is the Alumni Association. Like, it's $35 or whatever it is a year in dues. And then the lifetime membership, like I've got mine like 20 years ago, like, and it's been a lifetime membership. It's absolutely something everybody should be a part of and support. And that's with me not being anything official a part of it. I just go, I support it. They've asked me to help here and there, and I'm happy to do it. And my slamwrestling.net crew, generally do the bios. So we help put together the program. But that's, you know, that's self-serving too. It means we often get to talk to these guys and do the interview, but you know, it's for the greater good, right? Yeah. So they're out there in the Cauliflower Alley Club banquet. So you get your program, you can flip through and read all about whoever it is.
What wrestler, is there anybody that stands out to you that you researched for your various projects? And by the way, if anybody hasn't read any of your Hall of Fame books, like, they're top notch. And I think that was probably when I was first mostly aware of your work specifically. But what, any wrestlers for those various projects that you did that you found to be the most interesting of, you know, in terms of a story? Because, you know, you're a writer and you know an interesting story when you see one.
Well, I mean, there's a billion jillion fascinating stories, and every day I seem to discover a new one that you want to go down a path, right? And it's like a rabbit hole, right? I belong to a group of hockey historians, and so at one of the presentations one year, Kevin Shea was up there and he was talking about this football team, semi-pro football team that was in Toronto in the 1930s, and he mentioned a wrestler that was on the team. It's like, I don't know this guy. How did I not know this guy? So you start going into this research about Maze McLean, and I'd never finished the story yet, but like, that's the kind of thing that happens to me deep inside. And it's like, oh man, I got to know more about this. And so you plug away a little bit here and there, but to narrow it down, it's next to impossible. I worked on the Sweet Daddy Siki documentary, and there's somebody who is completely overlooked in so many ways for his importance, for his headlining as an African-American across the U.S. and in Canada, the fact that he had to leave the U.S. because he married a white woman and moved up to Toronto. That's part of the reason, not the only reason. But those kind of things mean that he had a lot more meaning to the greater scope than just what he did in the ring. And in the ring, nobody's going to deny he wasn't a pioneer and a fascinating figure and an amazing heel and a very strange bad or good guy when he was doing that. So there's another name, again, I've done so much research on that I wish more people knew more about.
I'm interested, too, as Adam Copeland is not in the WWE realm anymore, if Siki's name is somebody that can get out there a little bit more, because I know he talks about him, because that was his start in the business. If I remember, the essay contest was Siki, right?
Well, Siki was running it with Ron Hutchison. Right. Okay. And Ron was the guy in there doing a lot of the moves and teaching the guys, but Siki was the guy that was... He had worked on the gym before with Johnny Powers, and Johnny Powers left, and so Siki had the gym, and then Ron Hutchison came in to do a lot of the work. But yeah, in general, it was Ron that was doing a lot of the bumps and teaching the guys, but Siki was around, certainly for the first couple of years. But then Ron and Siki had a falling out, and this goes back to the early days of the internet. But I remember Siki calling me up and going, can you take my name off the internet so I'm not associated with Ron Hutchison? It's like, okay, Reg, I can't control the entire internet. I can do my little site, but I can't do every listing of every wrestling school out there and take your name off.
All right. So we're going to move on to something we call the three count. Now it's going to be three relatively quick questions. Some of them might deserve a little bit deeper of a dive and your answers to them. So this one's kind of a loaded one, but if you needed to teach someone pro wrestling history, who do you start with? Who are the most historically significant wrestlers for people to learn about if they're just learning about pro wrestling?
I think you go Fez, Flair, and I mean, more recently, you got a guy like Cena, because they all just, they knew their pattern, what they had to do. They carried themselves in a way that elevated the sport, which is a big part of me. I mean, I recognize Flair has become a little bit of a character of himself.
Right.
But you always knew he was the world champion. You always knew he was important. Cena's been like that. He holds his head high, never had a scandal. Luthez was an incredible role model. And you don't hear much about him other than, you know, every other thing that wrestlers do, right? They're looking out for themselves. You put other people over, but you want to make sure you're getting something in return. Those are the three that jump off the top of my head.
And Fez is a fascinating one for me, being a lifelong New Yorker, because he had some success in New York, but New York ended up turning more into Bruno Sammartino territory. So he's the one around here when you ask anybody over a certain age what they grew up on, and it's all Bruno. Like, everybody has a Bruno story around here. So
me too. I've got lots of Bruno stories. Yeah. One of the thrills of my lifetime was, you know, when I got off the elevator and we were at the Hall of Fame in Amsterdam, New York. And Bruno goes, hey, Greg. It's like, Bruno Sammartino, remember who I am?
That's awesome. That's fun. Second question. First off, my condolences to you as a friend of the legendary Butcher Paul Vachon, who we recently lost. What's it like to know the Vachon family and get to know what makes them tick?
it's wild. It's, well, the best example is when I first hung out with Luna. This was 2003, I think, because my first book had just come out, The Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame, The Canadians. And she took the page on the Vachons, had a red Sharpie, and wrote over two pages, you know, we put the fun and dysfunctional. And that, you know, the Vachons were not a dysfunctional family in that sort of grand sense, as in, and because I've done things like work on Medusa's book where her mom was a horrible figure. Her father had taken advantage of her father, which she didn't know. So there's all kinds of crazy things like that. The Vachons weren't really necessarily like that, but there's just so many of them. And they're in this wild business. You know, three of them get involved. And yet, having met other ones, like there was Guy and Sister, and a couple of the other Vachons at these various things through the years, they're just normal people, right? One might be an engineer, or one might, you know, have done this for their living. So we say Vachons, but there was 12 of them, 13 of them that were from that original family. And three of them got into wrestling. So 10 of them had normal lives.
Yeah. Just as a follow-up to that, has anyone... Were you ever able to figure out the Rocky Vachon connection? If the, like, what was the family? Was there a family relation with
Rocky Vachon? There was no relation to Rocky Vachon, the famed Hockey Hall of Fame goaltender. There we go, tying it all back in. He was the guy that took forever to get into the Hockey Hall of Fame. It just, again, he was on a lot of bad teams out there in Los Angeles and didn't get the respect he deserves. I can go on about hockey stuff a lot, too. If you want to throw out a name from that era, it's like Wilf Paymont. Well, his stats are the same as Clark Gillies, but nobody would ever say that Wilf Paymont deserves to be in the Hall of Fame.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And we can say that about a lot of wrestlers, too, right? It's like, oh, I held all these belts, but I'm not in the Hall of Fame. But no, there was no relation between the Vachons there. It doesn't mean they didn't play it up occasionally.
Yeah. Right?
Certainly, there's one of the things I've learned through the years is that sports guys – love pro wrestling and they love to talk about it. And there's a lot of wrestlers that love sports too. So Butcher Vachon, a big reason he got the Montreal Forum for Grand Prix Wrestling is because he ran into Jean Beliveau on a plane and they started talking, and Beliveau at the time had just retired and he was on the Canadiens board. So that's how he ended up having the forum to be able to promote shows. So there's a lot of connections between sports and pro wrestling.
And two things there. First off, the Rogi thing comes back to me of like when you're dissecting wrestling history, finding the work and where the shoot is. And that was the big part of like reading about Andre the Giant. You're like, I thought that that book was really good only because it was like, well, that it was accurate in that they presented every single piece of the work that he did. And so much of his legend was just not. You couldn't always tell what was legit, what wasn't. That Rocky thing, I literally never knew whether or not he was related. They mentioned it once in a while, and I never knew that. So, and I will stand with Clark Gillies, of course, because, you know.
Yeah, well, there you go. But yeah, like the fact is that Vachon is a pretty common name.
Yeah. And then my last question, I had to ask a hockey question. Who do you feel is the greatest New York Islander of all time?
I immediately think of Bossy. Yeah, when I think of the Islanders, I never got to deal with him. I've met a lot of the other guys or interviewed them through the years. But I think Bossy stands head and tails. He was just such an amazing goal scorer. And there's that what if factor, like how much better he could have been if he didn't injure his back, if he didn't smoke, like all those things, right? Yeah. We look back and we're setting today's standards against these players back in the day. But it's the same with the Bobby Orr. I mean, as great as he was, man, imagine if they have the knee surgery they have today.
Yeah. There was a great quote, and I'm trying to find it. It was about Bossy. It came out shortly after he died. It was at the Hockey News Awards. It was mentioned to him that he and Wayne Gretzky were the only players to have 9 50-goal seasons. And Bossy's answer right off the top of his head to the reporter was, that's true, but mine were consecutive. Which I love. I actually met most of those Islanders because I was born in 1979. So when I was born, the Islanders just started winning championships and I thought it was never going to end. So some of my childhood was spent around Islanders practice and meeting Islanders at that time. So I also met Bossy as an adult too, but yeah, it's fun. Greg Oliver, this was a lot of fun. We could keep going on probably any other topic of wrestling history for a while, but I really appreciate you coming on today and talking about the Halls of Fame. And I would love to do something like this again with you.
Absolutely. I mean, I do enjoy talking about wrestling history, especially. And anyone, I'm at slamwrestling.net. That's the site we've been running for over 25 years now. And oliverbooks.ca are the two places to find more about me. And but you can Google me too. I am out there. I'm not the, there's a couple of the Greg Olivers out there, but I'm the one, if you put Greg Oliver Wrestling, I'm definitely nice. Coming up.
All right, Greg, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Phil.
Thanks again, everyone, for joining me this week on Under the Ring Pro Wrestling Conversations. I want to thank Greg Oliver of Slam Wrestling for joining me this week. Follow me on Twitter at Under the Ring for the latest guest announcements, and have a great week, everyone.
Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.